stark differences between how Jewish people live there, Jewish Israelis live there, and how Palestinian citizens of Israel live in Lydd. Poverty, it's a city infested with crime. Almost every week there are a few murders, unfortunately, and we've all been a victim of this crime, and police are not doing anything about it, as you can imagine.
So Palestinian writer and activist Rami Younis, co-director of Lydd, originally from the city of Lydd. We were also joined by his co-director, Sarah Emma Friedland. You can watch our full-length interview with them at democracynow.org. Lydd is currently playing at the DC TV Firehouse Cinema in New York, showings followed by Q&A with the filmmakers. The film will also be shown around the country and around the world, including the Houston Palestine Film Festival next month, the Chicago Palestine Film Festival, at the Lemley Theater in Los Angeles, and Unseen Cinema in Nairobi, Kenya. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Shrifa Bokadous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermin Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamaria Studio, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Lelias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
The flowers are blooming, the birds are singing, KBOO's spring membership drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at kboo.fm/give between now and May 25th and support Avant-Garde Airwaves.
Saddle up and ride with country music in your head from 6 till 9 every Saturday morning on KBOO Swingin' Country. You can count on Swingin' Country's stable of rotating hosts to fill your early morning with country, alternative country, western, western swing, and even some rockabilly, bluegrass, and Americana tunes. Swingin' Country on KBOO is mighty fine, Saturday morning, 6 to 9.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon college students begin their own protest encampments in support of Palestine.
A train derailment on the Steel Bridge in Portland narrowly avoids disaster.
And tomorrow is the last day for Oregonians to change their voter registration for the May primary.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 29th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Ezra.
And I'm Reed Johnson. Pro-Palestine protests are building at Oregon universities. At 4:15 this evening, about 300 people were gathered outside the Portland State University Library. Students have blockaded one of the entrances to the library with pallets, tarps, and signs calling for PSU to cut ties with Boeing and other corporations involved in Israel's siege on Gaza. Though threats have been circling of police forcibly removing the encampment, so far there are no police present and the crowd is relaxed and energized. This is the fifth day of the encampment. Today, Reed College students have occupied the Reed Admin Building as well, with similar demands. On Thursday night, a pro-Palestine camp started in the PSU park blocks, but was then quashed by police. On Saturday, protesters met with University President Ann Cudd, who agreed to pause and re-examine the university's relationship with Boeing, which has ties to the Israeli Air Force. This is part of demands from protesters for the university to boycott companies that are involved with the Israeli military. Qud also gave the protesters permission to set up camp on the library steps, a spot that is PSU property, not Portland Parks and Rec, so cops wouldn't be pushing them out. PSU's response to protests stands out in contrast to how other universities in the U.S. are handling student protests against the Israeli war on Gaza. Some 800 people have been arrested in the last few weeks at campus protests around the country. Pro-Palestinian protesters at the University of Oregon in Eugene have also started an encampment outside their library. They say they won't leave until the school agrees to divest itself from countries that supply the Israeli military. They also want U of O to cut ties with Israeli universities and grant formal protections for students and faculty who speak up about the conflict in Gaza. Organizers met with campus safety officials and the dean of students this afternoon.
Five Union Pacific train cars derailed this morning on the Steel Bridge. According to the Union Pacific Railroad, the derailment occurred around 6:15 a.m. Portland Fire and Rescue shut down the bridge soon after to all traffic. They reported no injuries nor any concern about any hazardous materials. They say the steel bridge will remain closed until it can be assessed for structural stability. Photos of the derailment show a train car leaned against a structural support column. A major environmental crisis has been narrowly averted. Portland Fire and Rescue say the train was transporting lumber, propane, and other hazardous materials. It's not yet known what the derailed cars were carrying. Just two cars down from the derailed car, though, was a shipping car licensed to carry liquid natural gas. Local environmental advocates have been raising concerns over Portland's crumbling energy infrastructure. They point to the city's critical infrastructure, or CEI, hub along Highway 30, which houses more than 90% of Oregon's liquid fuel. A 2020 Multnomah County report estimated that the hub would not withstand a major seismic event and could release close to 200 million gallons of oil into the Willamette. There's a 26% likelihood of a major earthquake in Portland in the next 50 years. Train derailments, on the other hand, occur roughly three times a day nationwide. While most don't result in significant damage, the 2022 train derailment in East Palestine is a reminder of their potential impact.
Tomorrow is the final day to register to vote in Oregon's upcoming primary election. Voters can register online at OregonVotes.gov until 11:59 p.m. on April 30th. Voters can also check their party registration. Political primaries in Oregon are closed. So if someone wants to vote in a particular party's primary, they'll need to be registered. Mail ballots will be sent out starting on May 1st. The primary itself will be held on May 21st, 2024. Ballots received or postmarked at or before 8 p.m. that day will be counted. Postmarked ballots need to be received within a week, which often delay election results. Preliminary results will be posted to the Secretary of State website starting on May 21st and must be certified final by June 27th, 2024.
The state is still struggling to catch up with mental health evaluations for inmates after COVID. A mental health fitness evaluation is used to assess defendants in jail who are accused of criminal activity. The evaluation determines whether the defendants are able to aid and assist, which means they can understand their charges and work productively with a lawyer for their defense, or whether they need mental health treatment in order to restore their ability to do so. In Oregon, the wait for an evaluation can be months, with an average of 62 days before an inmate is able to be assessed. The delay is harmful to defendants, who often have to spend this time in jail, and it muddies the judicial process. Washington County Attorney General Kevin Barton told KGW, quote, "We are sidestepping the state hospital and using the private sector instead of following a bureaucratic process that was, in many ways, broken. The change is hailed as one that saves time, money, and speeds up justice for defendant and victim alike, but it raises concerns about the quality of the evaluations. More than half of inmates receive no mental health care while in jail, though mentally ill people are both more commonly incarcerated and more likely to be victims of violence. The 100 available evaluations are supposed to bring relief to a bloated court system and will be offered through partnerships with Northwest Forensic Institute and Lethia Forensics and Consulting, both of which specialize in mental health competency evaluations. Some defendants will still have to wait months for state competency tests. The county refused to provide data on the amount of evaluations it requires annually."
Wastewater treatment plants across the country are using the natural filtration system of wetlands to clean water and attracting sightseers along the way. In Oregon, the Clean Water Services utility established the 90-acre Fernhill Wetlands a decade ago. The environment has been thriving. Birdwatchers have seen more than 240 different species in the marshlands that connect to the Tualatin River and Forest Grove outside of Portland. Jared Kinnear is Clean Water Services Water Resources Project Manager and helped design the project.
I always say wetlands are the kidneys of the earth. That's what they've been doing. They filter pollutants, they slow water down, they capture sediment. We're just sort of harnessing that process that's been going on for billions of years and taking advantage of it.
The company also notes natural wetlands treatment costs about half as much as building a concrete treatment system. Similar systems exist in places like Florida, Arizona, and across the southern border in the Mexican state of Baja California. The Fernhill Wetlands' popularity has also led to the potential for bad press. In 2020, cackling geese ate fungus-contaminated grain in a nearby field, which led to a mass die-off in the wetlands. Kinnear says to some, it looked like the wetlands were the cause, although that was not the case.
They're looking at us like, is it the water, or what are you doing about this? We're in a fishbowl out there.
Recycled water is important to many ecosystems, including the lower stretch of the Tualatin River. That's where a reservoir and treated wastewater from Clean Water Services for treatment plants account for more than 80% of late summer flow. Kinnear says urban wetlands have been severed from their water sources, and treatment plants in the form of wetlands can help rectify that.
We can use this as a tool to restore wetland function and get all sorts of other benefits, wildlife habitat improvements. I mean, people value green spaces here in Oregon, and this is one way to do it.
That was Jared Kinnear, Water Resources Project Manager with Clean Water Services.
Grizzly bears will be returning to the North Cascades in Washington State thanks to a new decision from the National Park Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Over the next decade, they'll plan to capture 3 to 7 grizzlies from other ecosystems like the Rocky Mountains or BC and release them in North Cascades. The goal is to rebuild the population of grizzlies to about 200 in the next century. Grizzlies are a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act in the lower 48 states. They were killed in major numbers in the 1800s, and a grizzly bear hasn't been seen south of Glacier Park since the mid-1990s. They're going to be released under a special designation, non-essential experimental populations. That means that some Endangered Species Act protections are relaxed, and the bears could be killed if it's a matter of self-defense. Federal wildlife officials can also take the bear off the landscape if they start to threaten livestock. Grizzly bears are a keystone species that are crucial to the biodiversity and the resiliency of the environment. They're also important to the Upper Skagit tribe, who lived alongside them for thousands of years. A representative from the tribe, Scott Schuyler, told the Seattle Times, quote, "Just having them back as part of the ecosystem is a huge value to our culture and our history. Some of the best intact grizzly habitat remains in the North Cascades ecosystem in Washington. Roughly 85% of this land is under federal management. The National Park Service will be publishing updates on the timeline for moving the bears to its website."
In national news, Ukraine receives much-needed U.S. aid. Protesting college students call attention to universities' pro-Israel stances. And end-of-life care advocates stand up for minors' gender-affirming care in Montana. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I would caution anyone in saying that, in believing that one type of system is going to be a silver bullet. It's going to be a combination of a number of systems.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is confident about the impact of U.S. aid for Ukraine. This comes after President Joe Biden approved a $95 billion foreign aid package with $60 billion earmarked for that country in its war against Russia. Austin says the issue for Ukraine now is continuing to mobilize enough troops. Though the bill passed with strong bipartisan support, it didn't include measures about the border, which failed on bipartisan votes. Some Republicans continued to demand the return of Trump-era migration restrictions. Texas Representative Pat Fallon says his constituents want the southern border secured.
My constituents say over and over again, why are we securing Ukraine's borders when we won't even secure our own? And they have a valid point, and I'm very sympathetic to that being from Texas. I do think this administration has made every state a border state, and we need to address this. We can do both things at once.
A New York appellate court will hear oral arguments challenging the state's Early Mail Voter Act, which lets any voter cast their ballot by mail during early voting. Several conservative groups and Republican elected officials brought the suit. The case was dismissed by a lower court, saying the plaintiffs hadn't proven the law violated New York State's constitution. As college students continue protesting the war in Gaza, free speech groups are monitoring arrests. Police, including state troopers in riot gear on horseback, arrested almost 60 students at the University of Texas in Austin. Brian Klosterboer with the ACLU of Texas says protesters should follow law enforcement's guidance, even if they think their First Amendment rights are being violated.
It's important that people try to stay safe. Remember that they also have a right to remain silent. You can ask if you're free to leave.
The protests are sparking heated debate in the country's politics beyond the campuses. Some feel colleges are restricting free speech in a biased way. Others say the protests disrupt the institution's daily operations. Andrew Seligson with the nonpartisan group Public Agenda argues administrators shouldn't have their decisions dictated by outside interests.
Instead of making what they take to be the best judgments based on the values of their institutions and the facts on the ground, they're trying hard to avoid being the subject of pressure by politicians in Washington or in their state capitals.
Montana advocates for care at the end of life want the state Supreme Court to keep in place an injunction against a ban on minors' gender-affirming care. Supporters say the ban defends minors from making changes they'll later regret, but Callie Riley with Compassion and Choices says Senate Bill 99 could erode all patients' ability to make private health care decisions.
If the law is upheld, then that could also impact the ability of Montanans to make private healthcare decisions at the end of life, not just the right to pursue transition-related care.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacific Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $60,000 by May 25th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. On this episode, hosts interview author Rashid Khalidi on his book, The 100 Years War on Palestine. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 42. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 53. Today in history, in 1997, the Chemical Weapons Convention of 1993 enters into force, outlawing the production, stockpiling, and use of chemical weapons by its signatories. The quote of the day is from French mathematician and philosopher of science, Henri Poincaré, born this day in 1854. He said, quote, "It is by logic that we prove, but by intuition that we discover. To know how to criticize is good, but to know how to create is better."
A tribe in Michigan could be the first to grant legal rights to nature. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, tribal members in Michigan, are considering a resolution to formally grant legal rights to the natural world. IPR environmental reporter Ellie Katz has more.
The Rights of Nature resolution, if passed, would give legal standing to non-human life, including water, land, animals, and plants. It's part of a broader movement that seeks to offer the same legal protections to nature that individuals and corporations have. Thomas Peters Benesewagijic is part of a group of tribal elders that helped draft and introduce the resolution.
We as the Anishinaabe people want to be able to protect ourselves, plus we want to protect the environment that's around us that gives us life. And we have a connection to what we call Shkakimikwaw, which means Mother Earth.
Peters Benesewagijic says the resolution would expand on Anishinaabe teachings and treaty rights by ensuring that ecosystems and species have legal rights to exist and thrive. Grand Traverse Band tribal members can comment on the resolution now, ahead of a possible council vote in May. I'm Ellie Katz.
A Nevada grassroots organization has launched an initiative to champion Indigenous voices in the 2024 elections. Alex Gonzalez reports.
Taylor Patterson with Native Voters Alliance Nevada says the state is getting better about tribal and indigenous representation, but contends there's still a long way to go. Nevada is home to 21 federally recognized tribes and 28 reservations,
but only one native legislator.
Patterson says they saw the need to be more engaged with issues from the top to the bottom of the ticket.
I think very easily we can forget that Native people are everyday people. I think it's been painted in a very specific way. It still is very much a person of the past, but there are people that are in all different spaces that are engaging with the government in a multitude of ways that need to be represented.
Patterson says the state does have elected officials who understand the needs of the Native community, but hopes the new initiative will give those who are not familiar with the Native space an opportunity to learn more. Last summer, Republican Governor Joe Lombardo expanded Nevada's effective absentee system for elections program, which requires election clerks to meet with all tribes located in their respective jurisdictions to coordinate voting locations prior to elections. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
After 3 days of competition at the statewide Native Youth Games in Anchorage, students have returned home to show off their medals for traditional games like the 2-foot high kick, the kneel jump, and the seal hop. This year, more than 400 students took part in games that are not so much about competition, but an opportunity for each athlete to do their best. In Native Youth Olympics, competitors often try to encourage each other. Students say it's the spirit of the games which sets them apart.
Hi, my name is Camille. I'm from Kodiak. I love the togetherness that NYO brings us together.
My name is Grayson Damien. I'm from Mulvinook, and I love Indian stick pool.
My name is Maya Boger, and I'm from Chickaloo Native Village. My favorite thing about NYO is probably the sportsmanship.
The games drew about 2,000 spectators a day, including elders like Peter Black, originally from Hooper Bay. He says although Anchorage is a big village, the games bring back old memories.
I love NYO because I used to do same thing when I was a kid growing up, only in a village.
57 teams competed in this year's games hosted by Cook Inlet Tribal Council. The National Partners Working Group on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and the MMIW Family Advisors are raising awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous people through a week of advocacy now through May 5th. They're highlighting a list of their resources and putting the spotlight on efforts from tribal communities across the country ahead of May 5th, National Day of Awareness for MMIW. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Consumer groups are accusing major grocery retailers like Amazon, Kroger, and Walmart of price gouging both during and after the pandemic. The allegation of corporate greed comes from a new report from the Federal Trade Commission in which they found profits for grocery chains jumped sharply at rates that could not be justified by supply chain disruptions. Angela Huffman is the president of the nonprofit Farm Action.
It's one thing to raise your prices to cover higher expenses, but what these companies did is use the pandemic as an excuse to exploit the American people who needed to put food on their tables. And the FTC report shows that they're still doing it here in 2024.
The report found that the retailer profits rose to 6% over total costs in 2021 and 7% in the first three quarters of 2023, compared to 5.6% in 2015. According to a report from Help Advisor, California households pay the highest grocery costs in the country, averaging almost $300 a week, about $27 more than the national average. The Food Industry Association blames today's high prices on high labor costs and credit card payment fees. Huffman thinks the feds should take antitrust action to break up the competition and consider forcing the grocery behemoths to break up.
That would be the ideal outcome, is to take away their excessive power. But other than that, these companies can be fined for this kind of price gouging, and that's another action we would support. There needs to be some kinds of consequences.
The FTC staff report recommends, quote, further inquiry by the commission and policymakers, but it doesn't propose specific remedies.
Rates of suicide among young people have increased by about 36% in roughly the last two decades, and the surge has caught the attention of federal policymakers. The Biden administration has a new national strategy for suicide prevention and a federal action plan highlighting the need for a coordinated approach to prevention and equity in treatment and research. This follows the Bipartisan Policy Center's launch of a youth mental health task force in January. In Sioux Falls last week, task force co-chair and former Congresswoman Val Demings said rural communities face unique mental health challenges.
for example, having access to care, the affordability of care, removing the stigma. You may be in a substandard educational setting. You may also have substance abuse addiction in the household. And so we have got to, as a nation, deal with the social ills that cause decay in certain communities in the first place.
A big focus of the task force is a link between suicide and increased use of technology and social media. The U.S. Surgeon General says young teens who spend more than 3 hours a day on social media are at double the risk of mental health struggles, including depression and anxiety. Technology can also be used to help deliver healthcare services in rural places. In 2021, the Helmsley Charitable Trust launched a virtual crisis care program in South Dakota, equipping law enforcement with iPads so they can connect people with mental health professionals by video. Walter Penzier with the group has seen positive results.
We had a 75% reduction of transports to the mental health facilities. They were able to get care at home, locally. 25% of the calls was for youth.
People living in rural places are almost twice as likely to commit suicide than those living in larger cities, according to the CDC. If you or someone you know is in crisis, contact the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988.
Concerns about college affordability remain high among Americans, but few understand the actual price of higher education, specifically the price of obtaining a bachelor's degree, according to a new survey from Lumina Foundation Gallup. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story.
More than 70% of adults with student loans report having delayed at least one significant life event because of their debt situation. Yet a new Lumina Foundation Gallup poll shows few Americans seem to understand the cost of obtaining a bachelor's degree. During the 2021-2022 academic year, the average cost of attendance ranged from $10,000 per year at public two-year institutions to more than $56,000 per year at private four-year nonprofit colleges. Dr. Michelle Scott is president of College Now Greater Cleveland, a nonprofit that works to increase higher education accessibility. She says for students who are potentially first-generation college goers or from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, the conversations around college affordability can be overwhelming.
The issue for that subset of the population is really around helping them understand what college costs, but then more importantly, how do I afford it? What are the ways in which that I could afford whatever that cost might be?
The poll found more than half of never enrolled and previously enrolled adults say cost is a very important reason why they have not enrolled or re-enrolled in college. Unenrolled adults across race, age, and first-generation potential students consistently rate tuition cost as the most important factor in their decision to not pursue a college degree. Taylor says more efforts should also go toward helping students persist and complete their degree once they've signed up for those loans. She says higher education institutions could work better with college access organizations to communicate their programs and offerings in ways that are enticing to get students to want to enroll.
We want them to show better their return on investment. We want them to be a little bit more transparent about the cost and what the cost entails.
Data from the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center shows that in the 2022-2023 academic year, the number of undergraduate degree earners nationwide fell for the second year in a row. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
An Alaska Native community is experimenting with growing food above the Arctic Circle. Climate change is making some traditional foods harder to find, so community members are looking for new ways to increase food security. Dr. Anthony Leiswitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiswitz, and this is Climate Connections. Above the Arctic Circle, in Kotzebue, Alaska, college students and community members are growing greens, potatoes, and beans in campus gardens.
I think it's very important that we can grow our own.
Minnie Naylor is director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Chukchi campus. She says homegrown vegetables can help supplement traditional native foods.
We have bearded seal, caribou. We have a lot of fish, sea fish, trout, birds, ducks, geese.
But many of those foods are becoming more difficult to access. The growth of the commercial fishing industry, restrictive hunting regulations, and other pressures have interfered with subsistence hunting and fishing. and climate change brings new problems. Melting sea ice makes it harder to hunt seal, and warming waters are shifting where fish species can thrive. Meanwhile, food shipped to the region is pricey. So as part of the Food Security and Sovereignty Project, students and other volunteers are growing food using hydroponics and other methods. They're learning what works in their short growing season and sharing knowledge with others, so Native Alaskans can have more options for affordable food close to home. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 29th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Isabel Charlet, Reed Johnson, and Ezra. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramlagan, and Dr. Anthony Lysowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K2220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ezra.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, K282BH Philomath, and K220HR Hood River. Stay with us.